In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. In 1918, after years of bitter fighting in the First World War, the Bolsheviks resolved to sign a separate peace with Germany. And in response, the governments of Britain, France, America, and Japan launched a joint military intervention aimed at overthrowing the Soviet regime and recommitting Russian forces to the war. Historian Anna Reid spoke to Danny Bird about this overlooked Allied invasion and its dubious support for Russia's ultra-conservative faction, the Whites.
Anna, thank you very much for joining me today to discuss your new book, A Nasty Little War. We're going to jump straight in, and I was wondering, Anna, if you could begin by explaining the immediate historical context that prompted the intervention.
Well, the intervention begins in 1918, in the closing stages of the First World War. And what prompts it is the Bolshevik takeover, the Bolshevik coup, in November of 1917. Because up till then, Russia had been one of the Allies, along with France and Britain, and then later on America, fighting Germany. And great hopes had initially been placed in the Russian army. Popular press called it the Russian steamroller, and it was expected that it would sweep over the Austrian and German armies with no problem, because with vast Russian manpower. And straight away, it proved a disappointment, and the Russians suffered various defeats. And when they did have victories, they were extremely costly. And then in 1917, after Tsar Nicholas resigns in March, he abdicates, the whole Russian army starts falling to pieces. And basically, the French and British and American governments turn a blind eye to this. They sort of get sunk into wishful thinking. They think the provisional government, which takes over from Tsar Nicholas, is going to last and succeed in reviving the war effort. And it's plain to everyone who hasn't got the pink tinted spectacles on that this is not true, and the government's very fragile and the army's still collapsing. But nonetheless, when the Bolsheviks take over in November, taking over the public buildings in Petersburg and Moscow, almost unopposed, only a little bit of street fighting, it's a shock to everybody because they themselves are such a tiny group and almost unknown up to that point. Trotsky's been in exile in Siberia, Lenin's been in exile in the West. And then, worst of all, apart from being extraordinarily radical, they start peace talks immediately with the Germans. And this is the point at which the allies think we've got to try and overthrow them. We've got to try and get rid of them. We don't really care who replaces them as long as they start fighting Germany again, as long as they rebuild the Eastern Front.
Can you elaborate on the key nations involved in the Allied intervention in Russia? Were they all on the same page, or were they all pursuing their own objectives?
The key nations involved are Britain, France, Japan, and America. So the keenest to try and overthrow the Bolsheviks as soon as possible are the French, for two reasons. First of all, they've suffered the most, or at the beginning of the intervention, are still suffering the most in the First World War. A large chunk of France has been overrun. They've lost hundreds of thousands of young men, villages and towns destroyed. When Russia drops out of the war, when the Bolsheviks make peace with the Kaiser and Russia drops out of the war completely, they see that as this sort of heinous betrayal. And the second factor is that the French population in general had been a big investor in Russian bonds, in Russian government bonds, pre the revolution. So lots and lots of small French savers lost money when the Bolsheviks said they weren't going to repay the bonds, they weren't going to honour the bonds. That was another big factor. It made the new Bolshevik regime extremely unpopular in France. So France really sort of led the way, but Britain followed. Britain was a bit more detached. So, you know, you've got the Lloyd George national government bringing together all three big parties. And Lloyd George himself sort of swayed backwards and forwards rather on the intervention throughout, depending on how well it was going. But Churchill, once he comes into the cabinet right at the beginning of 1919, he becomes its chief cheerleader. But, you know, even before that, Britain is pro the intervention as well. And between them, Britain and France managed to pull in President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, who by sort of background and inclination is quite anti-war. You know, he had stayed out of the First World War, the war against Germany, as long as he possibly could. And he thought Russia was a mess. A lot of impossible folks is one of the things he wrote in his diary. And he was reluctant to get involved. He could see it was complicated and they would be getting in over their gumboots. But he basically let himself be persuaded by his extremely anti-Bolshevik Secretary of State, Lansing. And what allowed Lansing, after, you know, months of persuasion from Paris and London as well, to get Woodrow Wilson to commit was something called the Czech Rising, which is the takeover by about 50,000 Czech soldiers who had previously been part of the Tsarist army. They'd been fighting for the Russians against the Austro-Hungarians, who for them were imperial overlords. And when the whole army falls to pieces, the Czech regiments all stay together, take control of lots of troop trains and start moving east. Their main aim being to get back to Czechoslovakia, which they can see ever since Woodrow Wilson's, you know, famous 14-point speech about national self-determination. They can see an independent Czechoslovakia may happen and they want to join in on that. And they can't go the short way home because Germany and Austria are still in the way. You know, the war's still going on. So they go east to Vladivostok along the Trans-Siberian and they end up actually taking control of the Trans-Siberian through May, June of 1918. They knock all these little red militias that control all the various railway towns. They knock them over in short order and then also take control of Vladivostok itself and the terminus on the Pacific. And at that point, Woodrow Wilson is persuadable because, number one, with Vladivostok under Czech control, any American troops that land there can land safely. They're sure of a welcome. And number two, the Czechs have an appeal to his sympathy. You know, they're one of these small, brave, little self-determining nations who he has a fondness for and was talking about in his 14-point speech. And the American and press takes up the theme and, you know, writes these wonderfully romantic pieces about how the Czechs are this sort of rolling republic and this newborn nation and so on and so on. And so Wilson finally commits himself and sends troops to Vladivostok and also allows American troops to go to Archangel, where they fight in the north under British command. And the fourth big player is, of course, Japan. And Japan at this stage is already expansionist. You know, it's already been taking sort of bites out of Manchuria, out of Chinese Manchuria. And they see the Russian revolution and sort of Russia's collapse as a chance to expand their influence in the Russian Far East. And at the very beginning of the intervention, so still in 1918, the other allies, and Japan is allied with France and Britain already all throughout the First World War, they kid themselves that maybe there's a chance that Tokyo will actually send troops all the way to European Russia and help overthrow the Bolsheviks. Now, Tokyo has no interest in doing that. It's just interested in the Pacific. So it never sends troops any further west than Irkutsk on the next Lake Baikal. And so it's a sort of semi-participant in the intervention. It basically only intervenes in eastern Siberia.
What were the two sides in the Russian Civil War?
So it's not a two-sided civil war. It's a multi-sided war. It's extremely complex. So what basically happens is when the Bolsheviks take power in Moscow and Petrograd in November 1917, they've only got control of those two cities. And all the way around the edges of the old Russian Empire, you get lots of other governments, you know, so-called governments, often sort of tiny, evanescent little organisations, declaring themselves. And they span the political spectrum from rival types of revolutionary, the biggest group being the socialist revolutionaries, itself split into the more moderate ones and the more radical ones, to sort of outright monarchists, so ex-Tsarist generals down in the south, for example, who are very conservative, and a whole bunch of different national governments. So the Estonians, the Latvians, the Ukrainians, the Georgians, and so on, all declare national governments as well. And as the civil war progresses, you get all sorts of shifting alliances between these different groups. And the interventionists, the allies, to start with, basically back them all. But they don't care who overthrows the Bolsheviks as long as somebody does and starts fighting Germany again, you know, rebuilds the Russian army and starts fighting Germany again. So we're backing socialist revolutionaries here and outright monarchists there and Ukrainians here and Georgians there, lots of which loathe each other and are sometimes actually fighting each other. The most sort of paradoxical of these situations is up in the Arctic little port of Murmansk, where initially we actually back a local Soviet, a little red government there in the port against the Finns, the conservative Finns, who at that stage are in alliance with Germany. So the very first actual conflicts, these little skirmishes up in a field in the tundra, it's Brits helping Reds against white Finns, against conservative Finns. And that's sort of typical of it. There's all sorts of contradictory situations like that pop up again. So, for example, in the Baltics, later on the Baltic Sea, in sort of Riga, we've got the British Navy was helping Yudenich, who was a white Russian general, whereas our diplomat in the area, a man called Stephen Talents, who wrote a most brilliant memoir, he's helping the new Estonian and Latvian governments. And Yudenich, who the British Navy is helping, this white general, has total contempt for any sort of idea of Estonian or Latvian independence. He says, you know, the Estonian intelligentsia, there's no such thing. What a joke. Estonians aren't fit to govern themselves. There's no such thing as Estonian identity or Latvian identity. As it happens, the situation resolves itself because Yudenich marches on Petersburg, is repelled by Trotsky, who steams in on his famous red train and manages to turn him back again. And the Estonians and the Latvians, with a bit of British help from the Navy and us bombarding Red troops where we can get at them along the coast, win on their own. So the situation resolves itself. We don't have to make a choice and it just works out on its own. But that's sort of typical of the general messiness of the whole thing.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
What strategies did the Allied forces employ during that intervention, and how did these strategies impact the overall course of the Russian Civil War?
Quite quickly, the various governments that declared themselves around the edges of the empire became militaristic. The more centrist civilian governments that had originally declared themselves got pushed out by Russian military figures. And we went along with this and often actually encouraged this. The most important example of this is in Omsk, where actually elected, quite broad-based civilian centre-leftish government had declared itself, but proved little more than a talking shop. And very much sponsored by the Brits, a Russian admiral who had been in exile in Japan, as it happened, but a man called Kolchak, Alexander Kolchak, who was a bit of a hero, who was a bit of a rising star of the Tsarist Navy. He was sent to Omsk by the Brits to be this civilian government's defence minister. And in short order, he overthrew the civilian government and took power, called himself the supreme ruler. And it's very obvious from the records that he was helped in this by the Brits on the ground at the time. The general in charge of the British forces, you know, the small British forces, just a couple of battalions in Siberia, was called Alfred Knox. And he was an absolutely committed, conservative, pro the old regime guy. He was conservative overall, and Ulsterman, one of those many Anglo-Irish men who were at the top of the British Army at the time. And he actually threatened the Russian civilian government. We've got quotes from members of it saying he told us that we weren't doing any good, and if we didn't get our act together, we'd be swept away. And British troops sort of took Kolchak onto their train during the coup itself. They got him tactfully out of the way on a little trip to the front, brought him back the morning after. British machine gunners surrounded the government headquarters so that the Czechs, who were in town as well at the time, wouldn't rise up against Kolchak, because the Czechs were all very for the liberty, fraternity and egality business, as the colonel in charge of the machine gunners, as one of the battalions put it, who's another great memoirist. So we definitely helped put Kolchak in power. And similarly, down in the south, slightly later on in 1919, when we were deciding who to support in the south, we went for General Denikin, who was another, he's a Tsarist general, former Tsarist general, another very conservative figure. He had joined a rebellion against the provisional government in the middle of 1917, nearly succeeded in overthrowing it, and been imprisoned by the provisional government, then got out during the Bolshevik Revolution, had gone down south, got together with a bunch of other generals, and then formed this volunteer army and declared another government. And there are various people we could have gone with in the south. And the most biggest population group is obviously the Ukrainians, who had declared their own government and had their own military leader, a man called Petlura. And we decide not to go for them because they are split, the Ukrainians. And Petlura is not very strong. He's only able to hold on to Kiev very briefly. And we go with Denikin, who is, again, a conservative, though he hides behind this facade of soldierly apoliticism. He says, I'm just an honest, simple soldier. Any political questions like land reform or the new constitution, you know, those will have to wait till victory is won. So we end up supporting with men, with arms, with training, with money, these conservative military regimes. And that ends up with us turning a blind eye to the most appalling atrocities committed by our white allies. Everywhere, prisoner killing is absolutely routine. So you get massacres of dozens, if not hundreds, of prisoners at a time. And we don't ask, don't see. And one nice example I have of that from a British major who's down in the south, and he and a friend, they've gone out snipe shooting. There's quite a lot of downtime for all these guys, and they spend a lot of time on these incredibly uncomfortable sounding shooting expeditions. Right, they're riding into a village after their snipe shooting, and into it, the local Cossack regiment happens just to have herded several hundred prisoners, Red prisoners of war. And the next morning, the whole lot are shot. They're all taken out of the village and machine gunned. And our British major, he says, our opinion was not asked, and it was better not to see what had happened. You know, and there are lots and lots of examples of that kind of thing, not all on that scale. The prisoner killings is one thing, and the other big thing is pogroms against Jews, as massacres of Jewish civilians. And these are committed by all sides, by the Red Army, the Polish Army, by the Ukrainian Army, and by a bunch of sort of independent warlords, but also by the White Armies, which we are supporting, training, funding, arming, everything. And I won't go into the details of the pogroms, readers can imagine, but it's estimated that 150,000, maybe a bit more, civilians were killed in 1919 in total. And the worst of the armies, probably Petluras and a warlord called Hrihoryevs, but the whites not far behind. So you've got Jewish groups abroad hearing about what's happening and protesting to their governments. But the reaction is, particularly in London, is outright denial, dodging of the questions, you know, refusing to answer the questions, and these very, very token occasional telegrams to Denikin, Yudenich and so on, saying, don't let your troops commit excesses. That's the euphemism. And very much part of this attitude is that Churchill himself, who denies pogroms are happening in public in the House of Commons, brushes off queries. He's Minister of War at this stage and in charge of the British effort in Russia, never threatens Denikin with withdrawal of support unless the pogroms actually do stop. And the Americans are much tougher and pull out of Siberia earlier. And pogroms aren't an issue there because the Jewish population is tiny. But a nice example of how Denikin himself knew that the British protests were token. A Jewish deputation from Constantinople comes to him and says, can you please make a clear statement against pogroms and please sack the commanders responsible? And they point out that Kolchak has made a clear statement against pogroms in Siberia. And Denikin's reply is, oh, but here it's different. Over there are the Americans. So Kolchak actually has to pay attention to the Americans. But in the south, everybody except for the British has dropped out. So it's just the British he has to worry about. So the implication is you have to worry about the Americans, but not about the British. And the whole question of pogroms, you know, the word is almost unmentioned in memoirs or in the sort of official communications of the time. And even the word Jews is not mentioned. So they dodge the fact that the people being killed are Jewish. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is that amongst the British, as well as amongst the white Russians, Jews were blamed for the revolution. So it's one of the absolute central tenets of white propaganda and white ideology is that Jews made the revolution. And it's a scapegoating thing, of course. It's a way of avoiding the real reasons for the collapse of the old regime. And it's its massive unpopularity. It's a way of avoiding facing up to reality. And it becomes a sort of one-word easy explanation for all these sort of extraordinary events. You know, Jews made the revolution. It's all a Jewish plot. It's an international Jewish plot. And a lot of the British personnel, much, much less so the Americans, but a lot of the Brits believed it themselves. They themselves thought that, both in the army and the British establishment.
How did the Allied intervention impact the nascent Soviet regime?
Well, you have to remember that first of all, you know, to start with, the Bolshevik regime was incredibly fragile. And it was widely expected by Russians and everyone else that it would fall in weeks, if not days. And Lenin and Trotsky themselves were rather amazed that they managed to take power so easily. So their first tactic was to put off any sort of actual military intervention as long as they could. So for the first half of 1918, while they were in talks with the Germans and then actually making peace with the Germans, they buttered up the Allied diplomatic representatives in Petrograd, and then the capital moved to Moscow, as much as they could. And these diplomatic representatives were not the proper ambassadors, because we'd broken off diplomatic relations. We'd have no diplomatic relations with the new regime. So the ambassadors were off in a place called Vologda, which is sort of northeast of Petersburg, and then they decamped all the way up to Archangel. But we still wanted to keep sort of lines open to the Bolsheviks. So you've got these junior figures, French, American and British, in Petrograd, then Moscow, being chatted up massively by Lenin and Trotsky. They were given nice requisition palaces to live in. They were given loads and loads of face time. And the reactions, on the whole, they fell for it to differing degrees. Some would have totally bowled over by the glamour and the excitement of, you know, this revolution. And like Jacques Sadoul, the French representative, he actually left French government service and joined the Bolshevik government and became one of their chief propagandists. And then the British representative, I mean, man only in his 30s, called Lockhart, his dispatches home are all along the lines of the Bolsheviks are here to stay and we should do business with them. And he was himself was not a communist, didn't turn to communism, but he admired them. And he was a bit starstruck by them. So you've got this phase for a few months where the Allied representatives are hoping that they can persuade the Bolsheviks to actually allow landings of Allied troops who can help bolster the Eastern Front again. And they can reverse all these Bolshevik rapprochements with Germany and, you know, persuade them to start fighting Germany again. And the Bolsheviks are basically terrified of the thought of lots of, you know, hundreds of thousands of Allied troops landing and chucking them out of Moscow and Petrograd. So that phase ends in the summer of 1918, when you get proper landings of proper numbers of troops in Archangel and Vladivostok. And at that stage, the Bolsheviks arrest lots of the diplomatic representatives. They're finally let go again quite soon afterwards. But from then on, it's war, it's open war. And in a way, it's a blessing to the Bolsheviks, because the numbers of troops we land are actually rather small. Not enough, as it turned out, to tip the balance. But it's a propaganda gift to them, because they can now present all these alternative governments, even the moderate centre-left ones, as puppets of the imperialist, capitalist West. And there are lots of red propaganda posters one can look at where you've got maps of Russia with poor embattled Russia surrounded by sort of an evil Uncle Sam here and an evil British bulldog there and so on. And I think that did actually make a difference. It did harm the white image that they were backed by the West. I mean, they were seen as Western puppets. And of course, a lot of these governments were, in fact, Western puppets, as Kolchak was put in power in part by the Brits, you know, in Omsk, and Denikin was backed by British arms. They wouldn't have lasted very long without them. So definitely intervention, it made the Civil War last longer overall. The Bolsheviks would have won quicker had it not been for that. But it did help shore up public support for the Bolsheviks.
How did the Allied intervention affect public opinion and political discourse within the countries that were involved?
When the intervention begins in the summer of 1918, it's kept not exactly secret, but quite, as the term was in the time, hush-hush. It's discreet. It's not really publicly announced. So Britain sends a force down to Baku, in what's now Azerbaijan, and then, you know, up to Murmansk and Archangel, and it's kept deliberately low-key. And then with the armistice, with Germany beat, press censorship is lifted, and it's no longer possible to sort of keep a bit of a lid on the news coming from Russia. And also, more importantly, people at home and the soldiers themselves just want to go home. They think the war's over, we've won. What are we doing messing about in Russia? Let Russia stew in her own juice. That was the phrase of the time. Let Russia do her own thing. If she wants a Bolshevik government, she can have it. And that's mainstream opinion. But then also on the left and on the right, you've got people who are either opposed or support the intervention for ideological reasons. On the left, you've got something called a hands-off Russia movement. And that's in the States and in London as well. And it brings in quite a lot of sort of luminaries from the world of the arts and quite a lot of MPs as well. Many of them themselves with distinguished war records. So, you know, got a lot of credibility. And they have mass rallies in the Albert Hall and elsewhere and protest the intervention. It's strongest in Canada and America. And in Canada, Canadian troops actually refuse to board ship. This is in Victoria, Columbia, to sail to Vladivostok. And a whole bunch of them have to actually be sort of dragged on board ship at the point of a gun. And they sail to Vladivostok, sort of shut up in the hold. And they're so anti the intervention, anti having to be in Russia at all, that when they get to Vladivostok, they're never actually sent to join in any fighting. They just sit in Vladivostok and do a bit of light garrison duty and then go home again shortly afterwards. And the general in charge of British troops in the north, Ironside, when he hears of the armistice, he writes in his diary, "There's an armistice, doesn't feel real here, the war goes on for us, and I wonder what the effect on the troops will be when they hear about it." And they actually keep the knowledge that the war with Germany is over from the troops for as long as they can. And many people, you look at these American diarists, they don't actually hear about it for like another couple of months, extraordinarily. And it's quite easy to keep the knowledge from them since they're sort of stuck in little villages, you know, off down the rivers and the railway in the middle of nowhere. But once they do, they all start going on strike. Technically, it's mutiny. They start refusing orders to go to the front or to attack some village or whatever. But, I mean, really, it's soldiers' strikes. They're just sitting on their hands and doing nothing. They don't sort of scrag their officers. And the Russian troops, you know, there's a Russian army being raised there as well, and that does very violent mutinies. And gradually, these strikes and mutinies get more and more frequent until Ironside is completely, having been very positive about the whole thing, very pleased to have this high-profile command at the beginning, he's turned right off the whole thing and just wants to get his forces out as soon as possible without his white Russian allies turning on him. That's what he's actually afraid of by the end. The other thing that happens soon after the defeat of Germany is that Churchill is brought back into the cabinet and as Minister for War. And the main war is now obviously over. But Churchill, as well as being ideologically extremely anti-Bolshevik, he wants to retrieve his military reputation, which has been horribly damaged by the Dardanelles fiasco, by Antwerp, and the remaining field for military operations is Russia. So he comes out very strongly in support of the intervention. He wants to revive it. And through sort of sheer force of personality and eloquence, he persuades the rest of the cabinet to basically start a whole new front on the intervention, which is down in the south, to send troops, money, arms to Denikin, who's fighting in Ukraine and southwestern Russia. And he keeps this up, his wholehearted support for the intervention, throughout, even once you're getting towards autumn of 1919, and it's really obvious that the whites are losing, you know, all the white armies are in retreat. And uniquely amongst all the politicians involved, he doesn't try to distance himself from the intervention after it's all over. Everybody else, they often break off their memoirs or their published diaries in 1917 before the intervention begins. Or Lloyd George says, it was all Churchill, you know, he persuaded me against my better judgment. I mean, Wilson's already had his stroke, but his biographers say, oh, he was getting ill and he was never keen. But Churchill, to the end of his life, he carries on making speeches saying, you know, the white cause was good. Denikin did his best to stop pogroms. He was a progressive leader. So was Kolchak. And if only the political will had been there, if only we'd done more, they could have triumphed, which goes absolutely against reality. I mean, he kidded himself. So thanks to him, the intervention support for the whites carried on a little bit longer than it would have done otherwise. But we mustn't exaggerate it. It's a matter of a few months longer. In March of 1920, the white armies evacuate Novorossiysk and the British troops all go with them from their troop ships. And there's a small British representative force in Crimea for the very few last few months, supporting Wrangel, who's this extremely bloodthirsty white general, the sort of last stand white general. But it's basically all over in spring 1920.
What impact did the intervention have on subsequent international relations, and how is it remembered in those nations that were involved?
The most important long-term effect of the intervention was how it radicalised in Europe between the wars, how it made more fragile particularly the German government, because you've got these returning German troops, the Freikorps, who've been fighting in the Baltics after the armistice. And they come back with their arms. They hate the Weimar Republic. They feel they've lost their country. They don't identify with it at all. They're brutalised and they're nihilistic. And they drift into the early Nazi militias and are quite a big factor in the eventual fall of Weimar. And then you also got the mutinous French sailors. There was a French mutiny in Sebastopol early in 1919, which brought an end to the French occupation of Odessa and Crimea. And those sailors, the two ringleaders in that mutiny on these French ships, went home, were briefly imprisoned, let out under a sort of general amnesty, became elected deputies to Parliament, and became leading communist figures between the wars. And one of them went on and he was sort of political commissar for the international brigades in Spain. For Britain and America, it was a sort of wake-up call. You know, it was a humiliation and a sort of sign of things to come. So it turned America off adventures abroad. It fed into American isolationism between the wars. And for Britain, it was another intimation that the glory days of empire were over, like the Boer War before and the Irish War of Independence after. You couldn't launch any big adventures abroad without American backing, and you couldn't bite off more than you could chew. And I mean, more immediately, the fact that Churchill was so closely identified with the intervention, you know, the papers called it Mr. Churchill's private war. It discredited him after it was such a failure. It added to his pre-existing reputation as a sort of irresponsible warmonger. And it made it easier to ignore his warnings about Hitler later on. That was one of the worst effects, I guess, really, was that, was the damage it did to Churchill's reputation. One very interesting, sort of unusual aspect of writing this book was, of course, that Putin launched his new invasion of Ukraine just as I was actually getting to the end of it. I was coming up against my deadline. And it was extraordinary when writing about all this sort of bloody fighting in places in and around Kiev and Kherson and Kharkiv and so on and Odessa, that it was happening all again. You know, Odessa was being bombarded. Kiev was surrounded. Kharkiv would fall any day, you know, we all thought. It was like seeing history come to life in many ways. Putin's propaganda is extraordinarily reminiscent of white propaganda. It's ultra-nationalist. It denies legitimacy and agency to the non-Russian nationalities. It's tinged with anti-Semitism. It's sort of messianic. It's all about church, state, autocracy, you know, the three old czarist slogans. On the intervention more specifically, it doesn't really play a role in Putin's propaganda presently. It's too contradictory. That whole period is too difficult for Putin's regime. So the 100th anniversary of the revolution itself in 2017 went almost unmarked. So the whole thing was rather sort of passed over in official silence. And there's been some rehabilitation of the white leaders in the last 10, 20 years or so. So Denikin's remains, he ended up in exile in America and he was buried in America. And they were brought home from America to a Moscow monastery. And there was an absolute hit film called Admiral about Kolchak as well, thoroughly romanticising him. It's not a central trope of Kremlin propaganda today. What is, of course, is the Second World War. I mean, that's the big thing. It's all about the Great Fatherland War, not about the revolution or the civil war.
That was Anna Reid, whose book, A Nasty Little War, The West's Fight to Reverse the Russian Revolution, is out now, published by John Murray. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.